Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
Women compared to male peers earn less, occupy fewer top-tier positions, and receive fewer grants and scholarships.
It is water leaking out of a tap, not being put to any good use, and simply going down the drain. But a leaking tap is easy to fix, right? But how do you fix the consistent leakage of skills within a key sector of society?
A woman occupied very key senior positions in academia in comparison to their male counterparts, as well as earning on average 12% less for the same job.
I want you all to remember the number 29.1%. It is the percentage of women currently employed in science, both in part-time and full-time positions.
I'm hopeful that there are more voices and more perspectives to create meaningful structural change that uplifts women to excel in whatever research.
Gender inequality within academia and scientific fields is an issue all over the world. And even though more than half of the undergraduates and even more master students are women, only 29% of the employees at the universities are, and only 5% of the professors. Those numbers are global average. But gender inequality is an issue in academia, in all countries, even the ones who are considered pioneers within gender equality. Denmark is a country that's known as very gender equal compared to most countries around the world. And gender equality is embedded in the national self-awareness. But it seems as if the country has been resting on its laurels for the last 30 years when it comes to gender inequality in scientific fields, in both STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and in humanity, as well as social science. And even though several interventions have been implemented to reduce gender inequality, they haven't made a change. This episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast will dive into the gender equality issues within science and look at why science is so far behind in combating gender inequality in a supposedly equal country like Denmark. Ia Hye Utoft is postdoc at the Department of Political Science at Aarhus University.
My main interest and my sort of my anchor in my research is gender equality and diversity, primarily in universities, but I've also dealt with knowledge-intensive companies more broadly. And I'm also very interested in qualitative methods in different ways and feminist approaches to doing research.
One of your recent articles, you theorize Denmark as a post-feminist gender regime. What do you mean by that?
So the post-feminist gender regime is a theoretical lens. It's a way of trying to understand some dynamics in a society. It's like we can call it like a diagnosis, probably. So post-feminism is not a kind of feminism. So it's not like there are post-feminists out there. That's not the case. So we can can understand this post-feminist gender regime as a context that's characterized by a fundamental entanglement of feminist and anti-feminist ideas. So like Denmark, for example, there's this very strong narrative that we have gender equality. And this was ensured by feminists in the past. And that's great. We're very proud of this level of equality that we have. And then on the other side of that coin is, since we assume that we already have gender equality, we don't need feminism anymore or any kinds of feminist politics. When you don't have a feminist analysis, you don't have the feminist vocabulary, let's say, anymore, you can only understand people's experiences of barriers, discrimination, harassment, and so on, for example, in the labor market, as one-off rare individual occurrences, which then the victim must and can easily address on their own because everyone's presumed so equal and emancipated. Or we can understand, for instance, the Danish politicians' kind of, let's say, long-lasting passiveness in terms of having gender equality politics on the agenda, which has, well, in general for, let's say, a few decades been more or less absent, as a consequence of this self-narrative that we have, or that we are so progressively equal already.
But isn't it true that Denmark is a very progressive country compared to other countries around the world when we look at gender equality? Is it necessary to look at those structures from a feminist perspective?
It's very true that we are among the countries, the Western countries, that are advanced, I would say, with gender equality. And if we look back in the 70s and 80s, we were world leaders. So in terms of, for instance, women's access to education and women's access to the labor market, we were the best, basically. And it seems as if that kind of previous success has kind of embedded itself in our narrative about ourselves and about our country and our society, so much that this idea that we might still have problems that need addressing seems completely far-fetched for some people. Well, once you start to use it as a branding strategy, which has kind of been the case for Denmark, well, you can't really start to undermine your own branding strategy by saying, well, maybe we're not so equal after all.
Denmark is at the very top when it comes to gender equality compared to other countries around the world. Especially because women in Denmark have very good career opportunities and because the country has good and affordable childcare possibilities. But when it comes to gender equality in academia, Denmark is beneath the European average.
In Denmark, we have a very horizontally segregated educational system, which we see already in high school levels, that young boys and girls choose traditionally gendered fields of education. So it's usually divided so that women are in some sectors, traditionally feminine professions, and men pursue the more, let's say, the hard sciences when if they go to university.
The issues of gender equality vary a lot between academic fields. In STEM, the issue is very obvious because when you look around in the facilities, there just aren't any women. But in humanity and social science, where more than half of the master students are women, the low percentage of female professors becomes even more troubling.
Well, we still have a higher representation of male professors than female professors in the arts area.
The increasing inequality along the career path is very visible in the humanities, where 70 to 80% of the students are women, whereas only 33% of the professors are. From women being a majority as students, they become a minority as employees.
If you have a bachelor's and master's degree level, if you have a high share of women at those levels, it's much easier to recruit from them to become PhDs. So already then you have a much larger talent pool to pick from, right? So that's, of course, an advantage in the humanities and the social sciences compared with at least some or most STEM fields.
But PhD is a short-term fixed contract, usually for 3 years. And after the PhD, the next thing is to apply for a postdoc or an assistant professor position, which is also time limited.
And obviously there aren't postdocs or assistant professorships enough for everyone. So there will automatically be some attrition. Some people will not want to pursue careers in academia, want to do other things. And there will be someone who just don't get the jobs that are available just by trying, right? So that's one thing. And that's also part of this academic story that we have, that only the best make it to the top, right? So presumably it's the least good that fall out.
Another issue is that a lot of young scholars start families.
That's definitely an issue that face a lot of young scholars and women more than men. So it's a work-life balance issue, but it's also an issue of traditional gendered images that leaders may hold of what are the priorities of women once they have kids. So you might find that leaders within the university have the assumption that once a young scholar, female scholar, has kids, she will lose interest or not be willing to invest the same kind of effort in an academic career.
The next gender-biased bump on the road is international mobility.
So it's become like a mantra that to be successful in academia and to be eligible for a tenured position at some point, you have to go abroad for a longer period of time as part of your academic career track. So maybe do like a postdoc or of 2 years or something like that somewhere abroad. And there's also large literature on this that stresses that access to international collaboration is also highly gendered and skewed based on gender. So one thing is network. Since women tend to be a minority, like a numerical minority in their fields, in lots of fields at least, it's also much more difficult for them to get connections that will help them establish strong networks with people who might be willing to then be their hosts somewhere abroad.
Apparently, women who have families seems to be less mobile than men with families.
This is, of course, very heteronormative that we talk about. If women have families, usually there's a tendency that if the young scholar is a man, they would be more likely to be able to take their wife and kids with them abroad, whereas the opposite happens much less. So if the young scholar is a woman and her partner, a man, has a good career going on, that their partner would be less willing to make that sacrifice.
The first day he took me around the laboratory and showed me how to assemble a bioreactor, he asked me a question that till this day I cannot get out of my head. Do you want to be successful, Demi? Or do you simply want to be married and have kids? See, up until that point, I had been so shielded from the reality women faced in science that I did not even know this was a choice that had to be made. I also did not understand why this was being presented to me as a choice, because most of the professors I looked up to in the department were married with kids. What did not occur to me at the time was the fact that they were all male. So I shakily told him I wanted to be successful because it didn't seem like I had any other choice. I couldn't exactly stand there and say, oh, do you know why I'm here to learn how to assemble a bioreactor? It's because I wanted to churn out a husband for me.
One of the main issues at the associate professor level and the full professor level is that women don't tend to apply as much for the jobs.
And there are lots of theories about why this is the case. I mean, I'm not a big fan myself of like this narrative that women just don't have confidence, or it's like internalized imposter syndrome. I think there are also network dynamics that play into these things, that women have a tendency to be more likely to apply if they have received some kind of encouragement.
We still haven't achieved gender equality in most scientific fields, though women have been contributing to science since ancient times, and it can be traced back to the second dynasty of Egypt, 2700 BCE. Although many women did not get the recognition they deserved because men took the honor of their work, there is a long list of women contributing to science all the way up through the Middle Ages, and only to be expanded in the Age of the Enlightenment, when philosophy and science expanded knowledge of the world and used the results to question authorities such as monarchy and church. In 1636, Anna Maria van Schuurman was the first woman ever to attend university lectures. She had to sit behind a screen so that her male fellow students would not see her. She was a highly educated woman who excelled in art, music, and literature and became proficient in 14 languages. Despite Denmark being pioneering gender equality, we had to wait a long time before having the first female student at a university. In 1885, Nielsine Nielsen became the country's first female academic and physician. Nielsine Nielsen grew up in Svendborg. She was dissatisfied with the girls' limited schooling and noted in her diary that knowledge is power. In 1873, Nielsine Nielsen saw in a newspaper note that women could become doctors in the United States, and she made her decision. Women already had the access to study at universities in the United States, Switzerland, Russia, France, and Sweden, and it was therefore expected that the issue would sooner or later be taken up in Denmark. But it was Nielsine Nielsen's application that gave rise to getting the question on the agenda. The Faculty of Medicine believed that women were better suited for nursing than medical practice, and Professor Matthias Sachstorff was disgusted with women who would neglect their modesty to examine the male body and its diseases, including sexual transmitted diseases. And he compared female students to prostitutes, the latter being a necessary evil, and the first being a completely unnecessary evil. Despite oppositions, in 1875, a royal decree gave women access to study at the university, theology excluded. But it didn't give access to its scholarships. The main limitations were that women before the studies were cut off from the learned schools, and after the studies, they were not allowed to work at government offices. However, female doctors were allowed to practice.
And then we have to move all the way up to 1946, also Copenhagen University, when we had the first Danish female professor, who was Astrid Friis, and she was a historian. So it's quite a big gap in all of those years. And what happened in that time period is typically that women in academia were, of course, much more a minority, numerical minority than we are now, but that they also kind of were marginalized and put in very inferior positions as, let's say, lab technicians or lab assistants, and were never really allowed to shine until, for instance, someone like Astrid Friesen achieved her full professor title. And then we can look to the 1960s, which was what we could call the Danish university expansion.
The opening of two new Danish universities, the University of Southern Denmark and Roskilde University Center, opened up for much more women to enter the universities.
It's the pipeline analogy, right? So the more women you put in the one end of the pipeline, the more women will also come out at the other end.
But we never saw that. Though more women did enter PhD positions, it was a much smaller number than expected, considering the number of women graduating master degrees.
And one theory to explain that is that with the establishment of these brand new universities, they had to recruit a lot of teachers within a very few years of time to fill up all these positions that they had in the new universities. And they only had at that time men to choose from, or at least to a very large extent, only men to choose from or to recruit from. So you had a situation where you thought that all these new universities might prove like a doorway to creating more equality, having more women into the new organizations. And instead, it kind of was the opposite situation, that you established also these new universities that had a large majority of male employees. And this also contributed to establishing a very male-dominated culture and kind of precedence in these organizations. And what you find is that if you have this large majority of representation of one group of people, whether that be white people or men or whatever, they tend to reproduce themselves over time, because we have this affinity bias, right? That people that we can mirror ourselves in, those are also the people that we're attracted to, and then also are in most cases more likely to, for instance, recruit for jobs in the future. So this whole narrative that gender equality will fix itself as long as we just have more female students, we can see today that just doesn't hold.
Even though 61% of the master students at the University of Copenhagen are women, only 25 of the professors are women. But there has been some improvement, because back in 2006 it was only 14%. But despite that several interventions has been enforced, it is going slow.
A lot of people agree that we can't wait for this to fix itself. We have to do active interventions to try to kind of move this along more quickly.
And what do you think needs to be done to do that?
That's a really good question. I think, first of all, this idea of how progressive we are and that we have gender equality, just getting rid of those images and self-narratives is definitely the first step. Because if that's your mindset, that there really isn't a problem, then of course that will shape which kinds of interventions you'll then choose to implement.
The University of Copenhagen had their first gender equality action plan back in 2008. And the university have had gender equality action plans ever since.
And I remember that I commented in the media in 2018 on their kind of declaring after 10 years of consecutive action plans that they really hadn't achieved anything. That I wasn't too surprised about that, let's say. Because when you have that kind of mindset of understanding gender equality, or let's say women's lack of access to academic careers, as something to be fixed by focusing on women, or by adding like convenient intervention types on top of the existing academic system without really changing anything fundamentally, then you'll find that you probably won't achieve that much.
Now, you might think that women leave science for issues like work-life balance. And you'd be right, that is one of the valid issues women face. But you would also agree with me that there is a whole lot that goes on behind the curtain. Women leave science because we are tired of dealing with the deeply entrenched systemic bias that causes us to be seen as less than in this space. We are tired of narratives that say that we don't have the appetite for workload or the ability to deliver high-profile expectations. Women are tired of carrying the weight of misogyny on our backs, being told that, oh, you're so pretty, but you can't do science. We're tired of proving ourselves over and over again and still falling short. Not because we are actually falling short, but because the gatekeepers continue to raise the bar for us, while they keep it constant and, dare I say, lower it for our male counterparts. We're tired of being used to drive the narrative of women in science, told to smile for the camera so institutions can say we have a diverse space of women, when the truth is that we are excluded from the table of privilege and decision-making in that same space.
According to Ehe Utoft, the problem with a lot of the interventions made to improve gender equality at the universities is that they don't focus on changing the structures of the organization.
So usually we make the distinction between fix the women and fix the organization. While, for instance, a classic Fix the Women initiative is a mentoring scheme, right? So if you give a young female scholar a mentor, then the assumption is that that mentor will offer useful career advice, and then this young scholar will be better poised and positioned to succeed in her career, to make good choices, right? And while lots of mentoring schemes are very successful in kind of motivating the mentees, and the individual mentees may feel that they've benefited greatly from having a good mentor, you won't find that this solves a general problem of gender inequality or lack of access or equal opportunities for a whole group of people.
But how is it possible to fix the organization?
Gender inequality is a complex problem, and complex problems require complex solutions. So while it would be really nice if you could just do one thing and then that would solve everything, that's just not the case. So one thing is infrastructure. So it's really, really important that you have a leadership in the top that is prepared to go out and unabashedly and proudly announce commitment to this issue. But infrastructure is more than that. It is establishing a system that holds the organization accountable to the goals that they set internally, like what kinds of things do they want to achieve with this, let's say, a diversity initiative. So you would, for instance, have, you know, a top level diversity committee. So that's one thing. And then at all of the different leadership levels, you would have to ensure accountability, because, you know, irrespective of whether the leader in the top would say, this is what we want to do, we're committed, we have ambitious goals, you know, that will never succeed if you have roadblocks at each leadership level who say, every middle manager like says, this is not a problem in our department, I think it's unnecessary.
According to Ia Hugh-Utoft, it is necessary to have leaders who are aware of the problem of gender inequality and who are engaged in solving the problem. And then it's necessary to implement a system that holds organizations accountable for their goals in gender equality. And it has to be assured that all levels of leaderships have gender bias training and are held accountable for the performances in diversity, so there are no roadblocks along the way. But this top-down approach has to be accompanied by bottom-up approaches.
In a university, which is usually, you know, multiple thousand employees, you will always have like passionate people who are already somehow involved in maybe activism or political work that somehow relates to diversity or equality in some way. These people are huge resources that, you know, the company or the university will always benefit from mobilizing them in this work that they're doing. And it's not about putting the responsibility on them to kind of do the work for the company. It's about getting that passion. It's about getting their good ideas and to the benefit of the whole change process. So you can have both the top-down and the bottom-up mobilized at the same time.
And at last, there is a gender bias to the understanding of the rhetoric used in describing the requested skills in job adwords.
There is this tendency for academics to highlight the idea of academic excellence. So we only want to hire excellent researchers, irrespective of, you know, individual identities or whether they are men or women or whatever. But excellence is just a kind of a void, meaningless concept that we kind of use as if it's common sense. But the point with excellence is that as it just means everything and nothing, everyone individually has to inscribe meaning into what then it might mean. And what you find is that those kind of individual subjective connotations and interpretations of what an excellent researcher is also tends to have a gender bias. So one of the classics is that an excellent researcher is assumed to be someone who's prepared to go the extra mile, who's just willing to invest everything in their research. And what you find is that this usually applies to single people with no kids. And again, care connotes femininity, connotes motherhood. And then you find that women will be less likely to be able to, in, you know, recruiters' individual interpretations, to live up to this ideal.
In order to ensure that the changes are embedded in the organization, you have to go for small wins. For example, if you focus on recruitment, then you'll have to try that for a while and see if you get a more diverse pool of applicants.
So maybe you decide to, okay, we'll try and use different words and different kind of setups when we do our job descriptions that we post online when we have a vacancy. So we want to try and see, can we, by doing that, ensure a bigger pool of female applicants, or just in general, a bigger pool so that we have more talent to choose from. And then you say, okay, we might try this out for, let's say, 5 or maybe a bit more recruitment processes to see how that works.
And if it doesn't seem to make a change, then you go back and try something else.
Try something new, see how we go, evaluate thoroughly, and then go back and adapt. So that's the small wins. And you, as you can see, you know, these are things that you will not immediately be able to see the effect of on representation of women in professors. These are little things that will change the system gradually.
To ensure an increasing gender equality, it requires patience and long-term investment, and that the staff has a lot of skills and knowledge about how to avoid gender bias in, for example, recruitment.
So that leads me to my final point that I want to highlight, which is, of course, that in order to do this change work, you need gender scholarship and we need more support of gender scholarship. And of course, I say that very biased as well.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll see you as a professor in some years.
Hopefully.
Your research is primarily focusing on the academia in Denmark. Mm-hmm. But how is that compared with other countries? Is it the same tendencies that we see all over, or is it different? Is there some examples of countries where they really found a way to get around those inequalities?
That's a really interesting question, because yes, I would say at a very high level, we see the exact same tendencies, the attrition of women at basically all career stages. But back to my point about like being a bit critical, let's say fairly critical about the level of gender equality in Denmark, is that we see that, for instance, in countries in Eastern Europe who used to be part of the Soviet Union, they have much better equality in terms of representation of women in, for instance, the STEM fields. So in Denmark, there's this narrative that women just naturally tend to gravitate towards the feminine educations or the feminine professions, and men just naturally have better qualifications for doing technical or natural science work and so on. And it's kind of attributed to just, that's just the way boys and girls are. Whereas you see other places, it's not natural. It's about the systems that you have. And in the Soviet Union, I guess, I'm not an expert, there was just a need for everyone to pitch in, and gender might have played a smaller role in terms of deciding, you know, where you ended up and what kind of work you ended up doing. So they have a different history, which affects how that kind of horizontal segregation between the genders that we have very much in the Nordic countries is just less pronounced. And I can give you an example from some research that I did myself at one point, where I spoke to a young international scholar who was, I think, from Mexico, visiting here in Denmark at perhaps the physics department, at least a natural science department. And what he, well, of course, Mexico is a very patriarchal and also very sexist society. And what he found and what he commented to me was his utter astonishment of coming to this presumed, you know, gender equality heaven of Denmark, and then being at a department where there literally were no women. So it was really clear or kind of insightful to me that even this guy who comes from that specific context would come here and then find these very clear to him expressions of that we might not live up to the ideals about ourselves that we like to at least, you know, promote in terms of how progressive we see ourselves.
One of the reasons why a country like Denmark is so far behind gender equality in academia could be that, especially in the academic fields, where objectivity is an essential norm and the foundation science is built on, there is a belief that the best performing candidate will always get the position, despite gender, color, or religion. And acknowledging a gender issue can therefore be seen as questioning the whole idea of academia being objective, and therefore questioning the whole foundation of science.
So when I first entered this world of gender equality in academia, which was like 5-6 years ago, we would always kind of start discussions with the question, do we have a problem? And most people would say, obviously not, because we have gender equality, equal access, equal opportunities. If women don't succeed, it's a question of merit, because we have meritocracy, which ensures that only the best candidates make it to the top. Whereas now it's a whole different picture, I would say. I think there is a window to address these questions in the leadership, which is really encouraging. And it seems that, well, this time when we ask the question or we try to address the issue, discuss the issue of gender equality, we don't start with, is there a problem? We start with, how can we address this problem instead? And for me, that's a huge difference. But whereas it seems that the leaders are more committed to this issue now, there is also a rising opposition, which I feel like has only strengthened in those 5-6 years. So those who were very critical back then are even more critical now. And that's a fact of trying to do gender equality work in academia. There is this polarization.
You see this polarization within the universities and not just in politics.
Of course, you can't really, it's an artificial division, right, with between society and what happens inside academia, because definitely the political kind of movements and tendencies happen inside and outside of the university, no doubt about that. However, there is this link between this ideal of objective science and meritocracy in a way that that kind of makes people assume that since scientists do objective science, we are also the best people situated in the best possible way to objectively assess other people's qualifications. So it's like this picture of, you know, if we're not able to objectively assess people, irrespective of gender, irrespective of any other kind of defining identity category or identity marker in any way, whether that be skin color or if you wear a hijab or whatever it might be, that shouldn't matter in a meritocracy, only scientific qualifications. So once people start to question that ideal of meritocracy and science's ability to assess each other only based on merit, then you also kind of attack, I think they would say attack, or at least touch on their self-image as scientists. So it's also kind of a critique of this whole idea of objective science in general. And I think that's part of the why this opposition in academia might even be stronger, or at least kind of more vocal than what you might see, for instance, in a company or whatever other place it might be.
The story of gender inequality in the scientific fields ended up being a lot about Danish academia, which was not the original idea. But I find that Denmark is a very interesting case relating to the issue of gender inequality in science, because Denmark has this history and self-confidence of being progressive towards gender equality. So it is an example of how gender within academia needs extra care.
Not all women. I know that's a common thing these days. Not all people share your story, Demi. Some women are successful, and that's true. The UNESCO Institute of Statistics that say that of all science professors in the world, 5%, a whopping 5% are women. It's amazing for gender parity, isn't it?
Thanks for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast, which was funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails Foundation. The music is originally composed by Hjelte Birsted Møller, also known as Trumleorkestret. Find future episodes on scienceandcocktails.org or where you find your podcasts.